Let us know.
Okay, thanks. So let me start. Yeah, so sorry again for the trouble. So I would like to talk about the point of view about sub-quantum gravity and try to see it as a topological quantum field theory with defects. And I would like to argue that this is related to this this idea of constructing new vacua and new representations for loop quantum gravity, and in particular try to construct a vacuum for that can accommodate the presence of a cosmological constant. So this is based on work in collaboration with Bianca Dissi. If we go to slide number one, I give some motivations. So the idea is that we have recently realized that there are in fact different vacua, different vacuum structures for the kinematics of loop quantum gravity. And these can in fact also be used for spin foams and potentially group field theory. So this begs a very natural question, which is that of the reason for which there are all these vacua. So we could ask how many vacua exist, how these different vacua are related to one another, and eventually what we would like to know is how these vacua can be used for really physical applications, if they can really help us understand better the physics of the of loop quantum gravity and spin foam models. So the results which I would like to present in this talk go take a little step in this direction. And so namely what we do is that we will extend the construction of the previous BF vacuum that we constructed. So the previous BF vacuum was a flat curvature vacuum, so a vacuum peaked on flat connections. And so we will extend this to the case of a non-vanishing cosmological constant. So to be a little bit more precise, we will do this extension in 2 plus 1 dimensions in the Euclidean case, and we will do the extension to the case of a positive cosmological constant. So I will try to argue that although this looks pretty restrictive because we're doing 2 plus 1 dimensions and Euclidean positive cosmological constants, in a sense, this is the most peculiar case to consider. And maybe if we understand this case very well, then this can tell us how to consider the other cases. And so maybe the bottom line of the talk is that we can sort of conjecture the following mathematical structure, which is that the fact that we have different vacua for loop quantum gravity and excitations on top of these vacua really looks like we are dealing with topological quantum field theories with defects. This is what I would like to argue in this talk and give some examples to show that this might indeed be the case. So on slide number two, we have the outline of the talk. So in the first part, I just want to motivate this idea that we can probably see loop quantum gravity as a CQFT with defects. Then in the second part, I will just recall some features of this new representation, so this so-called BF representation. Then in the third part of the talk, I will present the construction of the vacuum in the presence of a cosmological constant, and then I will give some conclusions and perspectives. Okay, so now we can go to slide number three, the first part. So here I just recall some well-known results about the kinematics of loop quantum gravity. So as usual, we work with the holonomy flux algebra. So this data encodes the geometry of spatial hypersurfaces, both extrinsic and intrinsic geometry. And so I just want to give this reminder here because it's important to remember that we're working with these so-called gauge covariant fluxes. So these simplicial fluxes are in fact defined with some additional parallel transport. And for this reason, these fluxes turn out to depend both on the continuous electric field and on the connection. And so it is well known in loop quantum gravity that based on this holonomy flux algebra, we can construct some diffeomorphism invariant Hilbert space representation of this algebra, and then in turn we can derive some notion of quantum geometry. And very importantly, if you try to think about the role of the vacuum structure in the kinematics, essentially the vacuum tells us how we can take a state, refine this state, and embed this state in a sense in sort of a continuum limit. So because of this structure, what we are able to do is to construct the continuum limit at the level of the kinematics of the theory. So this in itself is not too useful because what we're really interested in is the dynamical continuum limit. But at least it's a very kind of neat mathematical structure. This will also be important for the rest of the discussion. So of course the important question is the question of the continuum limit at the dynamical level. So this question could be phrased as follows. So we could ask, how does a smooth diffeomorphism invariant spacetime emerge from our description in terms of basic building blocks? And it is very probably likely that this emergence of the continuous spacetime will probably take place in different phases. So maybe what we will have to do is investigate the potential phase diagram of our discrete gravity model. And so if we sort of try to address these questions, and if we take maybe a renormalization point of view or a field theory point of view on our informed and loop quantum gravity theory, we have to ask the question of what is the vacuum state. So is there a preferred vacuum state? Are there many different vacuum states? And if we start with a preferred vacuum state, how do we reach a certain continuum limit? This is what we eventually would like to investigate. So if we go to slide number 4, I would like to ask the following question. So the question is whether loop quantum gravity is actually a discrete or a continuous theory. And so maybe the answer to this question is that loop quantum gravity is in fact both things at the same time. And the reason is that for all practical purposes, we always work on a finite graph or on a finite triangulation. But we know, because of the existence of the kinematical continuum limit, that we can think of these states as living in some continuous Hilbert space, which here I denote by H infinity. And so, in fact, if you try to think of what is, in a sense, a theory which is at the same time discrete and continuous, well, this is kind of naturally a topological quantum field theory with defects, because we can think of this as being a genuine field theory, but with arbitrarily finite number of degrees of freedom.
So to motivate further the fact that quantum gravity is present in the space, we can look at what happens at the classical level of kinematics. So we know that if you work on a finite graph, you can associate a space case with the graph, what I call the LTG space case on the graph. Yeah.
Mark, it's difficult to hear you now. It's difficult to hear you now. Can you come closer to the mic, please, if that's possible?
Yes, okay. We'll try to speak louder and closer to the mic.
So we know that we can associate a classical phase space to loop quantum gravity on a fixed graph. And this phase space is essentially the Cartesian product over all the links of the cotangent bundle of SU2. And the reason for this is that for every link of the graph, we have a holonomy, which is a group element, and a flux, which is a Lie algebra element. And this together parameterizes the cotangent bundle of SU2 seen as a group manifold. And so there is a construction which can show us that this phase space on a graph is in fact isomorphic to some symplectic reduction of the phase space of full continuum gravity. So this is this equation which I wrote with colors. So this isomorphism tells us that this L2G phase space on a graph is the same as the phase space of gravity, where we look at almost everywhere gauge invariant and flat connections. So the phase space of gravity in red is just the cotangent bundle of the smooth SU2 connection. The notion of being almost everywhere flat connection is encoded in the choice of a graph. And gauge invariance and flatness of the connection is imposed by these first class constraints, F and G. If we construct this symplectic reduction, we can show that there is this equivalence between the spin network phase space and the phase space of full continuum gravity. But now if you have this idea in our mind that the kinematics of loop quantum gravity is like that of a TQFT with defects. Yes?
I guess there's maybe a typo, like in your first equation that's not the gauge invariant phase space, and then in the second one it is. So just to clarify your notation, which space are you going to be really interested in? Like the gauge invariant one or just the non-gauge invariant one or of Cartesian products of P star of SU2.
No, sorry, for the rest of the talk, I would be interested in the gauge invariant.
Closer to the mic, please.
Sorry?
Get closer to the mic, please.
Okay, sorry. So now we have to ask a natural question, which is the following one. So if you want to see the kinematics of loop quantum gravity as that of a TQFT with defects, you have to be precise about the choice of TQFT, so which TQFT we mean, and what kind of defect.
Mark?
Yes?
Excuse me, we couldn't hear your answer. Can you repeat it?
Yeah, in fact, I'm afraid I can't, because I'm already intimately close to the microphone. I cannot.
But I mean, if you can repeat the answer to the question.
Sorry. No, so I said to Simone that I was going to consider only gauge invariant states for the rest of the construction. And in fact, this will not be too important. I will be more precise in what follows about what happens to gauge invariants.
Thank you.
Mark, whatever you're doing just now, in the last 2 seconds, just do the same thing, because even when you say you are close to the mic, sometimes you fade out, sometimes you fade in. So whatever you're doing last 1 minute, that is ideal. So please do that. Thank you.
Okay. So we have two examples of these TQFTs and defects in loop quantum gravity, and these give rise respectively to these two inequivalent representations. So we can think that in the Ashtekar-Lewandowski representation, the vacuum, or the TQFT itself, is given by a state of BF theory, which is just completely vanishing electric field. So these are completely degenerate geometries in the sense that there is no geometry at all. The electric field is vanishing. And in this representation, we have defects on top of this TQFT, and the defects themselves generate the geometry. So they carry themselves the geometry. Then, by contrast, in the BF representation, what we have is a vacuum state, which is a physical state of BF theory, but now this state does not correspond to vanishing electric field, but rather to vanishing curvature of the connection. And in this representation, we have defects, but the defects now generate curvature instead of generating geometry. So these are the two examples of this choice of state of a TQFT and defect structure on top of this TQFT. And so classically, if you look at this kind of reconstruction, that we can send the discrete data, holonomy and fluxes on a graph to the continuous phase space of gravity, these different geometries are just gauge choices in this reconstruction. But even though at the classical level these are just gauge choices, in the quantum theory what happens is that if we work with these two representations, they lead to inequivalent quantum representations. So this is usually something to be expected. If classically we just make a canonical transformation or a gauge choice, it can be that at the quantum level we get inequivalent quantum theories. So now I go to the second part of the talk, which is to contrast the Ashtekar-Lewandowski representation and the BF representation. So if we go on slide number 5, I have this table which just explains briefly the main differences between these two representations. So on the left, you have the Ashtekar-Lewandowski representation, and on the right, the BF representation. So as I said, we can think classically of the background of the AL representation as being given by vanishing electric field, and the background in the BF representation as being given by vanishing curvature of the connection. Then in the quantum theory, the vacuum state for the AL representation is just an empty graph. So it's just empty space itself, which indeed is the most natural diffeomorphism invariant state, because there is just no graph and no geometry to be acted on by diffeomorphisms. Then in the BF representation, the vacuum state is not just a state of nothing, but it's a state parameterized by holonomies of the connection. So I write this state as a product over some fundamental cycles of the graph, and for every cycle we have a group element, which is just the holonomy along this cycle, which is peaked on this identity. This is guaranteeing for us that we have a state which is peaked on flat connections. This is just flat connections written in terms of, in a discrete way, which means in terms of group elements. Now the excitations in the Ashtekar-Lewandowski picture are given by holonomies. So when we act with a holonomy on the vacuum state, we just create a link of a graph which is labeled by this new holonomy which we just added. So in this sense, the basis of excitations is labeled by the dual graph, because the holonomies live on these dual graphs. Now, in the BF representation, the creation or excitation operators are not given by the holonomies, but are given by the fluxes, and more precisely, some exponentiated version of the flow generated by the fluxes. So to be more precise, if we act with a flux, with an exponentiated flux, which I call R here, which has the group element parameter H on the vacuum state, this is going to shift the cycle holonomy labeled I by the group element H by acting either on the left or on the right. So in this sense, when we act with these creation operators, we're going to shift the vacuum state
away from flat curvature by locally putting curvature on a given cycle of the graph. So in this sense, we can think of the excitations or the basis of excitations as being labeled not by dual graphs, but now by d minus one simplices. Because geometrically, we know that the fluxes of loop quantum gravity, they are supported on d minus one simplices. If we look at the 2 plus 1 case, the d minus 1 simplices are just a vertices of the triangulation. So the defects, as I said, we have this background TQFT and defects which generate degrees of freedom. In the AL representation, the defects generating geometry are the dual graphs themselves. But in the BF representation, the defects generating curvature are d minus 2 simplices. Now, we also have to ask how to refine state if you want to construct a continuum limit. And in the AL representation, the refinement is just given by putting the spins on the link equal to zero. Now, in the BF case, the refinement is given by the flatness constraint. In this sense, this flat refinement is really the refinement dictated by the dynamics of the topological spinform model. So we can think of this flatness refinement as being given by the gluing of spinform amplitudes, which in the topological case are just telling us that we go from one coarse state to a finer state by putting some additional flatness constraint for the new cycle. So now in the quantum theory, if you want to turn these structures into a Hilbert space, we of course have a measure in both cases. In the Ashtekar-Lewandowski case, we just inherit the Haar measure from SU2. But in the BF case, if we require that the vacuum itself be a normalizable state, and if you require that there exists some inductive limit of Hilbert spaces, if you want to be able to construct the kinematical continuum limit, we cannot use the usual Haar measure, because otherwise these delta function states would not be normalizable, but we have to use some discrete measure. So this is kind of the peculiarity of this BF representation. And now if we have this, these objects at hand, we can in fact construct the kinematical continuum limit, and I just put these check marks here to say that this kinematical continuum limit, so this kinematical continuum Hilbert space, exists in both representations. Now we know that we can slightly generalize these representations because in the AL case, what we can do is consider a vacuum which is not given by a vanishing electric field, but which is rather picked on some fixed background geometry. So this gives rise to the so-called Koslowski-Salman representation. And in fact, there is kind of an analog generalization which we can do in the BF case, which is to consider a vacuum state peaked not on a flat connection, but peaked on a homogeneously curved connection, so something with constant curvature, which would be like gluing together not flat simplices, but simplices with constant curvature. And so this is the way to accommodate the presence of a non-vanishing cosmological constant. So this is what we want to do in the rest of this construction. So on slide number six,
this limit that we're taking, okay, so yes. until the point where you have got the measure on your table, everything is on a fixed graph or a fixed complex on the right-hand side, simplicial decomposition, and then you take the limit. Is the limit on the right-hand side for the BF completely rigorously defined, or are there still open issues there?
I would say that the limit is rigorously defined, yes.
On the right-hand side as well. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Mark, we can't hear you again.
Sorry. So I was just saying that, yes, it is rigorously defined. So now on slide number six, I would like to give some extra details about the BF representation and argue that there are some advantages as compared to the AL representation. So the first advantage is that in this BF representation, what we can deal with, what we really work with, is these gauge covariant fluxes, so the fluxes which depend on both the electric field and the holonomy of the connection. Then, because we work with these fluxes, there is in fact a very nice geometrical interpretation of some operators. So in particular, if you look at diffeomorphisms in 2 plus 1 dimensions, you can really see that the action of diffeomorphisms is just given by vertex displacement, which is really a nice geometrical interpretation. Now what happens is that because we have, in a sense, exchanged the role of the holonomies and the fluxes, when we refine states, or when we coarse-grain states, what we really do is that we are refining or coarse-graining the geometry itself. So what we're doing is really an operation on the fluxes themselves. And this is kind of a nice feature also, because what we would like to do is to have a procedure and have an understanding of how the geometry itself, so the fluxes themselves, get coarse-grained. And in particular, if we look at the coarse-graining of the geometry, what we have in this representation, so because we work with these gauge covariant fluxes, what we have is that there is a nice interplay between curvature and torsion excitations. And by torsion excitations, I mean violations of the Gauss constraint. So in particular, if we look at this figure, if you look at this triangle, which has, so the big triangle has three edges, E1, E2, E3. If you look at the flux associated to these three edges, if we compose these three edges consistently by summing these fluxes in the same reference frame, you can see that the sum of these fluxes will not be vanishing if there is some curvature located around the vertex V. So if this holonomy GV around the vertex V is not the identity, the sum of these fluxes will not be zero. So this is kind of illustrating this interplay between violations of the Gauss constraints and the presence of curvature. And so now this allows me to jump ahead of myself a little bit and give you a flavor of what will happen later on. And this is the relation with point particles in 2 plus 1 dimensions and what we call the structure of a quantum double. So
Mark,
you can see that...
Question?
Yes? Yeah?
Do you have this interpretation of diffeomorphisms as a vertex displacement also in 3 plus 1, or what would replace it?
No, we don't have an interpretation in 3 plus 1, because in 3 plus 1 the situation is... So basically because of the difference between BF and diffeomorphisms in BF and diffeomorphisms in gravity. So this is the question of what happens to the simplicity constraints in 3 plus 1 and, you know, whether you should move vertices or edges of the triangulation. So for the moment, we don't have really a clear answer to this.
So are you mean to say that what you actually have as vertex displacement are the BF shift symmetries? That in 2 plus 1 you can always interpret as... diffeomorphisms, but is less obvious in 3 plus 1?
In 2 plus 1, it's the case, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So in this BF representation, what we work with is exponentiated fluxes, which, as we argued, generate curvature excitation. And if you think...
I can't hear you.
Sorry. So if we imagine for a second that we're working at the gauge variant level, so that we're not at the gauge invariant level, we have gauge transformations, and these gauge transformations, they generate, in a sense, violations of the Gauss constraint, so torsion excitations. So if you work with exponentiated fluxes and gauge transformations, so which are, in a sense, given by two group elements, because exponentiated fluxes are parameterized by group elements, and so are gauge transformations, what we can do is generate curvature and torsion excitations. But we know that in 2 plus 1 gravity, if we couple two point particles, curvature and torsion are in fact related to the mass and the spin of the point particles. And it is also known that mass and the spin of these point particles, they label the unitary irreducible representations of the gauge group which appears at the quantum level if you have point particles, which is some deformation of the classical gauge group SU2. And namely, this is the Drinfeld double of SU2. So this is labeled by a mass and a spin, essentially. So this is kind of pointing towards the fact that what we're secretly dealing with by doing the BF representation is that we're nicely and naturally accommodating for the presence of point particles. So we'll make this more precise in what follows. So now we go to slide number 7, so the third part of the talk. So which is the constant curvature vacuum. So here I give a bit the setup of the construction and explain what we want to do. So the setup is that we want to look at 2 plus 1 space-time dimensions with a non-vanishing cosmological constant. And we know, because of the various quantization schemes of 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity, that essentially in the quantum theory, what will happen is that the classical gauge groups will be turned into deformed gauge groups. And what we will have is the appearance of quantum groups. So then we have to ask, So this is a big problem in loop quantum gravity, the understanding of how precisely these quantum groups arise from the quantization of classical 2 plus 1 gravity. So I would just give a disclaimer now about what we will not do in this talk, but this is just maybe an idea for what should be eventually studied. So what we could do in order to accommodate for the presence of a cosmological constant is what I call study the dynamical emergence of the quantum groups. So we know that if we take a 2 plus 1 gravity in the Euclidean case with a cosmological constant, in the first order formulation, the gauge connection is again an SU2 connection. The cosmological constant only appears in the Hamiltonian constraint, which becomes f of a equals plus or minus lambda e wedge e. So the SU2 BF vacuum, which we have already constructed, is a genuine and is a good kinematical vacuum state for this formulation. So what we could do is start with the SU2 BF vacuum, which we already have, and then try to solve or implement a proper regularization of the Hamiltonian constraints with the cosmological constant. So this I would call a dynamical way to incorporate the cosmological constant. So this is not what we will do here. What we could also do is what I call a kinematical emergence of the quantum groups. What we could do is do something analogous to what was done by Nui, Perez, and Pranzetti, and what is also done in transimons theory. So we know that we can replace this Hamiltonian constraint, f of a equals plus minus lambda e wedge e, by a flatness constraint, f of omega equals zero, where omega is a new connection, which is like a Poincaré connection, which in fact combines the original connection A with the triad field E. So what we could do is look at this non-commutative connection, A plus or minus square root lambda E, and look at holonomies of this connection. And now based on these kinematics, we could also try to construct a new BF vacuum, but a BF vacuum for this new Poincaré connection. So this could in principle be done, and again, it is not what we will do here. So what we will do here is now in the part strategy and goal, what we will do is assume that we have a quantum group structure from the onset. So we just assume that the quantum group structure is given for us from the beginning. So now, depending on the sign of the cosmological constant, something kind of peculiar will happen. For example, if we have the Euclidean theory with a negative cosmological constant, we know that classically we can deform the phase space, which is given by ISU2. So this is just the three-dimensional Poincaré group, so SU2 plus a translation part. If you put a cosmological constant, it is known that this gets deformed into a classical phase space, which is SL2C. So this is a genuine classical phase space, which has a group representation. And what we could do is construct a vacuum based on this group SL2C. But what is more interesting for us, what we will do is study the Euclidean case with a positive cosmological constant. Because in this case, we know that what happens is that the quantum group that appears is a deformation of SU2, where the deformation parameter is a root of unity. And because of this fact, because we have a root of unity as a deformation parameter, it turns out that there is no group representation for this quantum group. So although we call this a quantum group, there is no group picture. We cannot write a group element for UQ of SU2. But the TQFT corresponding to the quantization of 2 plus 1 gravity with a positive cosmological constant is known, and this is just the 2⁻⁰ TQFT. So the challenge here is that we want to show that we can construct a BF representation when there is a positive cosmological constant, even though there is no group picture. And this seems rather unsettling at first because of the construction which we did previously. The way in which I presented the BF vacuum, the vacuum state itself is a product of delta functions of group elements picked on the identity. So we need to have a polarization in which the wave functions depend on the group elements themselves. So therefore, if you have quantum group at root of unity, and if you have no group elements, it is a priori very problematic because we cannot even write the first step, which is to write down the vacuum state, because we don't have group elements. So what we will show here is that everything still goes through, and to be more precise, we can show that the 2⁻⁰ TQFT with defects is just like the BF vacuum with a cosmological constant and with excitations, which is thereby kind of realizing this idea that the structure of a vacuum with excitations is the same as the structure of a TQFT with defects. So if you have this in mind, if you want to construct this BF vacuum with a cosmological constant, we need to construct several ingredients. So what we need to do is we need to come up with a way of writing down and manipulating states. And the reason for this is that there is no group picture. If there is no group picture, how do we write down the state and how do we manipulate states? Then the second thing is that we have to be able to write down a Hilbert space which contains states, and in particular, we want to identify two kinds of states in this Hilbert space, namely the vacuum state and the excited states. And then once we have this structure, eventually what we would like to do is be able to write down a creation or an excitation operator. So what we have to do, in a sense, these three steps, 1, 2, 3, is really mimic what we did before for the SU2 flat BF representation. So we have to find a way to write down the vacuum states, and find a way to write the states, then find a way to construct a Hilbert space, and then find a way to construct creation or excitation operators to generate excitations on top of the vacuum. So now I would like to present these three steps. So maybe I stop to take a question at this point.
Yeah, so can you tell us if in fact at the last transparency, the program that you sketched, does that automatically take into account dynamics, or is it still at a kinematical level? When you say vacuum, is it a kind of, in some sense, dynamical vacuum or excitation?
Yes. Yeah, thank you for the question. So this is still at the kinematical level. So what we are not going to do is describe a dynamics for these defects.
Okay.
But I will argue that these defects are in fact labeling the behavior of point particles. So in principle, we could give dynamics to these defects by really putting an action for these point particles. But this is indeed a kinematical structure. Okay, so if we go on slide number 8, we have the first step of the construction.
Mark, this is Carlo. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I missed the very first slide, I was not there. So it's related to the last question. Are you thinking that the dynamics, it's related, is equivalent to I zero, or you're thinking the dynamics is going to be something different?
No, so there is two things, right? So if you look at the vacuum state itself, we can think of the vacuum state itself as being, in a sense, a canonical slice, a two-dimensional slice of the Tourette-Virot model. And the Tourette-Virot model has no dynamics in the sense that the dynamics is just flat refinement, right? Because it's topological, there are no degrees of freedom. But then, if we have excitations on top of the vacuum, we can think that this is taking us outside of the Tourette-Virot model. But in fact, if you have excitations on top of the vacuum, you will see that these excitations, they are just like the presence of point particles. So in this sense, I'm claiming that kinematically, having the vacuum is like having the Tourette-Virot TQFT. Having excitations is like having the TQFT with defects, and these defects are like point particles. So this is just kinematical. And so what is not done here, but what should be studied, is the dynamics of these defects. And maybe we can give dynamics to these defects just by considering the dynamics of these point particles in the Tourette-Virot model. Is this...
What is the classical physics? What is the classical limit of the physics you're describing? In which dimensions are we? Maybe I'm lost. Are we in 2+1 dimensions or in 3+1 dimensions here?
We're in 2+1 dimensions, Euclidean with a positive cosmological constant. So the classical limit is 2+1 gravity with a positive cosmological constant.
But why? I'm confused. So what are these extra degrees of freedom that you're putting in? Are you doing gravity or gravity plus matter?
No, for the moment I'm just doing gravity.
So why do you have extra degrees of freedom?
Maybe I have the same puzzle.
I'm confused, sorry. This might be stupid questions. It's just my confusion.
No, so there are two sides of the question, right? So from the purely mathematical point of view, people have studied these TQFTs with defects, which they call extended TQFTs. So people know mathematically...
What is the physics being described? What is the physics? What are you describing physically? Gravity in 2+1 dimension, Euclidean, or... gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensional Euclidean coupled to matter.
So it's 2 plus 1 Euclidean coupled to matter, coupled to point particles.
Okay. Okay, this is what was not clear to me. Okay, thank you.
Sure. So if we go on slide number 8, I present the first step of the construction, which is how to write down and how to manipulate states. And this we do by following tools of graphical calculus. So essentially, in summary, this all arises from the fact that this quantum group, UQ of SU2 at root of unity, is in fact sort of a strange name, but it's a modular braided fusion category, which I call C. So I would just like to explain these four terms, and hopefully this will be quite clear. So the first term is a category here. So these representations form a category because we have all these objects which are just given by the irreducible representations of UQ of SU2. So if Q, the deformation parameter, is the root of unity, we know that there are only a finite number of irreducible representations, and these are half-integer spins ranging from 0 to k over 2, where k is the level of a transimons theory. So k can be thought of as the infrared cutoff of the theory. So you can see that k scales as 1 over square root of lambda. So k is kind of given us the max, the biggest length, which is allowed in this De Sitter space. Now the fusion structure on top of this category comes simply from the fact that we can look at tensor product of representations labeled by spin j. So more precisely, this means that there exists some fusion coefficients, n, and these fusion coefficients tell us how a representation k appears in the tensor product decomposition of two representations I and j. So if we take the tensor product of I and j, we get a sum over all the representations k, and these fusion coefficients are either 0 or 1, depending on whether k appears or not in this tensor product. So if you want, these fusion coefficients...
Yes?
Technical question. Do you mean to make a difference between a fusion category and a tensor category?
It will not be important here, but it's important in the in slightly more abstract context, in the condensed matter literature, where they don't only look at UQ of SU2, but here I don't want to make the difference.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. So now the third term, braided, this just comes from the fact that on this quantum group UQ of SU2, there is a notion of braiding. So if we start drawing graphs, so where the strands of the graphs are labeled by spins, irreducible representations, what we can have is non-trivial over or under crossings of these graphs. And in fact, these crossings are resolved by using the so-called R matrix. So I have just drawn an example here. If you have the strand I crossing over the strand J, you can undo this crossing by just multiplying by this coefficient R IJK, which is the R matrix, which is completely known and well-defined without ambiguities for UQ of SU2. So all these objects are just very simple algebraic expressions in terms of the spins. And then the fourth term, the modular property, comes from the fact that we can define a modular S matrix for UQ of SU2. So this S matrix is just some coefficient, 1 over D, times the evaluation of this Hopf link. So this link is just the knotting of these two links I and J, and this defines the entries, so the coefficients Sij of the S matrix. So we say that this category is modular if the determinant of the S matrix is different from 0. And this coefficient D, which I introduced here, will be important later on. This is sometimes called the total quantum dimension of the category. So maybe some of you recognize that this D, in fact, is what happens in the Toura zero spin foam model. This is the weight which is assigned to vertices in the Toura zero model. So this quantity D is divergent in the limit of zero cosmological constants. So for the Ponzano-Regge model, this would be divergent. And for Toura zero, this is finite. So this is like the regulator of the Toura zero CQFT. So now we know that in this CQFT, for UQ of SU2, the dynamics is just topological invariance, in fact. And this topological invariance or the dynamics, or if you want, the spin form amplitude, is just given by a quantum version of the 6J symbol. And this quantum version of the 6J symbol appears if we look at the recoupling of four spins, I, J, K, L. We can do this change of recoupling basis, and this change of basis is given by this F symbol. So what I call F here is just the quantum 6J symbol. So on this slide, we have all the kind of simple mathematical ingredients and graphical representation which we can use to manipulate states. So states are going to be just represented by these graphs. So this is just like usual spin networks, in fact. So in the BF representation, we were writing states as functionals of the holonomies. Now we can think that we are doing the Fourier transform of these group elements. So we work with spin labels. And we just argued that in the quantum group case, we can only work with these spin labels. There is no Fourier transform which takes us back to the group representation. So what we can do is only draw spin networks. And once we draw spin networks, we have to manipulate with certain rules. And because we have a quantum group, so these rules for manipulating these spin networks have to be the rules given on this slide, because these are the rules of this modular braided fusion category. So we just take these rules for granted. I try to motivate where they come from, and we manipulate the states with these rules. So if we go on slide number 9, I give a sketch of how to construct the ribbon graph Hilbert space. So to construct this Hilbert space, what we can do is take a 2D manifold, sigma, and put punctures on this manifold. So I call this manifold with P punctures, sigma P. So what is important is that the puncture itself has some internal structure. So we have to think of a puncture as being obtained by removing a disk on the manifold and then placing a marked point on the corresponding boundary. So this is kind of the internal structure of the puncture. The puncture carries a marked point, which, so I will argue later on that this is important for the construction. So now what we can do, what we want to do is allow for graphs in this manifold to have open links ending at the punctures. So in principle, for usual spin network states, for spin network graphs, we would never allow for graphs with just open links, because at the at this vertex, this one valent vertex, at the end of this open link, this does not satisfy the Gauss constraint. So typically, these states are excluded from the gauge invariant Hilbert space. What we want to do here is allow for states, so allow for graphs which have links, so single links ending at the punctures. So now what we can do is define formally a vector space as the span of all the graphs in this punctured manifold modulo some local equivalence. So these equivalence relations are kind of easy to understand. The first one is just telling us that we can smoothly deform the links of these graphs. Okay? Now the second equivalence relation tells us that locally we can always perform this change of basis or this F move. And you probably recognize that geometrically, if we think of this graph as being dual to a triangulation, this F move is just, in a sense, the algebraic analog of the Packner 2-2 move. So on the geometrical side, at the level of the triangles, we do Packner moves. And at the algebraic level, in terms of representations and quantum 6J symbols, we do this F move. And then the third move is what we could call the bubble move. So it's enabling us to remove bubbles in the graph just by introducing some additional coefficients. So di, dj, dk, so these d are just the dimension, so the quantum dimension of the representations of spin I, j, k. And in fact, what we can show is that if we combine the second and the third relations, so these 2-2 Packner move and the bubble move, what we get is the 3-1 Packner move. So if you want, in a sense, what we're doing here by imposing invariance under these local equivalence relations is that we are, in some sense, erasing the information about the triangulation. Because we know that we're dealing with a TQFT, so the model itself is topological, so it should not depend on any local choice of triangulation, but only on the global information about the manifold. And in fact, all these local equivalence relations tell us that we can perform all these deformations on the graph because we have a topological model. So this is the reason, in a sense, for which I did not refer to particular triangulation. So this is already one difference with the standard BF representation, namely the fact that for the BF representation, we had to work with a triangulation. Here, there is no triangulation in this construction, at least for the moment. So now I give some examples. Yes?
At least think in 2D for a physics system, is to think of, about them, right? It's two-dimensional.
Yeah, this is 2D, yeah. So these are, this manifold is 2D.
For the moment, there's no particle I should think about. Or should I?
If we go on slide number 10, I give an example of this Hilbert space, so simple cases. So if we take this manifold to be the two sphere, then we can put a certain number of punctures in these two spheres.
I think there are some questions in perimeter which none of us heard, so that you are trying to answer. So can you tell us what the comment or question was?
Yeah, so Wolfgang was asking if the punctures themselves were not going to carry represent point particles. And I told him
we cannot listen.
So we will come back in a minute to the role of the punctures.
I just want to give two simple examples. So these examples are based on the two sphere with zero and one puncture. So this is on slide number 10. On slide number 10, you can see that a two sphere with zero punctures is topologically trivial. So this means that if I draw any graph on the surface of this two sphere, I can always use these rules of graphical calculus or these local equivalence relations, which we introduced on the previous slide, to reduce any graph on the two-sphere to just some number, which is, of course, going to depend on the spin labeling of this graph, times the empty two-sphere, so the two-sphere with the empty graph. So in this sense, we can take this two-sphere with empty graph as a basis of this one-dimensional space. Now, if you put one...
The graphs live on the two-surface or in the three-space who's bounded by the two-surface?
No, the graph lives on the two-surface itself.
Graph lives on the two-surface itself. So in your second example, does just a puncture with no graph, doesn't that violate Gauss's law?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, you're right, Lee. So in the second example, I allow for the presence of one puncture. But this case is a bit degenerate in the sense that if you just put a single puncture, you can also use the previous rules of graphical calculus to show that you will never, in a sense, see the links which end at these punctures. So in fact, even this state which I draw here can always be reduced to some number times, again, the sphere with one puncture and empty graph. So again,
the
space is one
number zero?
Sorry?
Is that number zero? What's the dimension of the Hilbert space with one puncture?
So the dimension is one. And in this example which I draw here, the number is not necessarily zero. It will depend on the spin labeling the link which ends at the puncture. So if the spin is not zero, then the number is indeed zero. Does this answer your question?
I'm confused, but that's normal. Go ahead.
So on the next slide, slide number 11, we look at the most important case. And this is the case of the two-sphere with two punctures. So you can think of the two-sphere with two punctures as being topologically like a cylinder. So because we have a cylinder, we have, in a sense, always a non-contractible cycle. So this means that we will have now the first non-trivial states, and these states correspond to any allowed spin labeling. So by this I mean that the trivalent vertices have to have incoming spins which are allowed by the fusion rules, and any allowed labeling of this graph, which I represent here on the sphere, is a legal state from the point of view of this Hilbert space. So you can see that in this graph now we have a link which is connecting the two punctures. And there is also a loop which is winding around one of the punctures. And because we are at the surface of a two-sphere, it doesn't matter whether we wind around the upper puncture or the lower puncture. But this is showing us that there will be states on this two sphere with two punctures, so on this cylinder, which we cannot reduce with the graphical calculus just to a number times the empty graph. And the reason for this is that there is now a non-contractible cycle which is going between the two punctures. So if we have just a link of a graph going around the puncture, because of the presence of these two punctures, we cannot shrink this link. We cannot just shrink this link and evaluate it. So this means that we have different states now which are non-trivial. So the Hilbert space is not of dimension one. And in fact, the dimension of this Hilbert space can be computed if we introduce this Q basis. So if you look at this Q basis, what I have drawn here is just the same graph with some spin labelings, I, J, R, S, and I have completely removed the two sphere. So we have the two punctures, so this reminds us of the fact that we are working on this two puncture, two sphere, or on the cylinder. And in fact, the dimension of this Hilbert space, dimension of H2, can just be computed in terms of these fusion coefficients. So because we have two trivalent vertices, so one of them has incoming spins I, J, and R, the other one has incoming spins I, J, and S, the dimension of this Hilbert space is just given by this sum of this product of fusion coefficients. And of course, this dimension will depend on the level which we choose. And remember that this level is telling us the number of allowed spins with which we can color the graph. So for example, you can convince yourself that if we take the level to be 1, so in this case, there are only two spins, spin 0 and spin 1/2, then this Hilbert space H2 is four-dimensional. There are four different non-equivalent states on this two-puncture two-sphere. So now, maybe to go back to Lee's question, this shows that the punctures, and also to go back to Wolfgang's question, this shows that the punctures now, they can carry kind of two different structures. The first structure is that they can carry curvature, because we have these non-contractible cycles around the punctures. And the second thing is that the punctures can carry torsion, in the sense of violations of the Gauss constraint, or equivalently, in the sense of having open links ending at the punctures. Okay? So now I just also want to comment, so the next two points are just two comments. The first comment is that if we insist on introducing a triangulation picture, we can still see these graphs as being dual to triangulations, although, in fact, degenerate triangulations. And in fact, we can extend this construction of this Hilbert space and this basis for arbitrary topology and arbitrary number of punctures. And the extension to arbitrary topology essentially comes from the fact that we know how to cut a manifold of arbitrary genus into a pens. And usually this pens decomposition corresponds to chopping up the manifold into two punctured spheres and three punctured spheres. And once we have these basic building blocks, we can again assign basis states to these basic building blocks and glue them together. So just to say that this construction works for any arbitrary genus and arbitrary number of punctures. Now if we go on slide number 12. On slide number 12, I want to construct the second ingredient, which is a way to characterize the vacuum state. So we can think of the vacuum state as being selected out of all the states in this ribbon graph Hilbert space by two projections. And this construction, in fact, is known in condensed matter because this is just an example of the Levine-Venn Hamiltonian. So these two projections acting on these states are given by a gauge invariance projector and a flatness projector. So the gauge invariance projector, which I call BV, is just acting on vertices of the graph. So schematically here, I wrote that if BV is acting on a vertex which has spins ijk, this is a trivalent vertex with incoming spins ij and k, this is going to be zero if this triple of spins is not admissible, so if gauge invariance is violated, and this action is going to be one if the triple of spin is admissible, so if gauge invariance is not violated by these spins. Now the second projector is the so-called flatness. So this BP operator, so as the the label indicates, is acting on punctures in the following way. So if you act with this projector BP on a puncture, this amounts to putting this coefficient, 1 over D, then summing over all the spins, which, remember, is a finite number of spins. Then we put a quantum dimension DJ and a Wilson line of spin J around the puncture. Now let me define this operation. So putting a Wilson line of spin J, multiplying by DJ, and summing over J with this coefficient, let me define this as a new type of line, which is this thick dotted line going around the puncture. So this is just the definition of these new thick dotted lines. But now if we look at the graphical properties of these new thick dotted lines, which now I will call vacuum lines, for reasons which hopefully will become clear, these lines have the property that any standard strand of labeled by a representation J can freely slide over this region. So even if this vacuum line is encircling a puncture, any strand can freely slide over this vacuum line. So because of this, you can see that this flatness projection, so whose action is to put a vacuum line around the puncture, is in fact making the puncture invisible from the point of view of the other strands. So in this sense, this operator is removing the curvature which is carried by the punctures.
Does it also remove the torsion?
So torsion is removed by the previous operator, BV. So these should think of these as being together.
So this was the first argument to, in a sense, show that this flatness projector is selecting a class of states which corresponds to the vacuum, in the sense that removing the curvature information carried by the temperature. Another way to see this, which is more intuitive, look at what
would
happen in the classical
case. Cannot hear.
So in the classical case, in the SU2 case, if you look at the definition of this BP operator, this is in a sense just the sum over J of the characters, which are these closed Wilson lines labeled with spin J. And in the classical group case, this is just the Peter Weyl expansion of the delta function for the group. So in this sense, this is imposing flatness of the connection. Now, the second reason, I would like to argue that this is in turn related to the TQFT itself. What we can show is that if the graph that we work with is dual to a triangulation, if we evaluate, in a sense, the matrix element of this projector between these two graphs, between the same graph, what we compute, essentially, is the 2-0 invariant of the manifold sigma times some interval, so of this 3D manifold. So this is completely analogous to what happened in the BF representation. In the SU2 BF representation, what we said is that we do refinement with the spin form amplitudes, so with the physical amplitudes of the theory. So refinement is flat refinement, so it's obtained by gluing spin form amplitudes, so vertex amplitudes, 6J symbols on top of the states. Here the same thing happens. You can think of this BP operator as being the refinement operator, so the flatness operator, except that now it's not flatness for SU2, but flatness for the quantum group, which we can only write in terms of spins because there is no group representation for quantum groups.
Just a question about clarification there. So gamma is a state, there is no
function. No, you could put functions on.
Wait, you say zero to a simulation.
Well, you can think of these punctures as being at the center of faces of the...
Okay, then I don't understand the right-hand side. The right-hand side is in the right-hand side. Then the right-hand side is in the right-hand
side. I just don't understand what you mean by... No, so both things can be made into a number, right? If you, if I sum the...
So it's the expectation value of gray little sigmas on,
yeah.
On the stage gamma.
Sorry, a basic confusion, Mark. So you said you're considering extensions of the Turev Miro model with punctures now. But then you say that this operator that represents somehow a delta function with puncture, this B, gives you the Turev Miro model itself, which has no punctures, right? It's just curved tetrahedra. So I lost something at some point. Can you please explain again?
In a sense, you can think of two that people as already having punctures. If you think of these punctures as being just vertices,
we kind of hear.
Instead, that in the usual two that zero construction, since we don't look at excitation, we don't look at defects, we never think of these punctures as being something physical. We never think of the punctures as being defects. We never think of the punctures as carrying torsion.
Wait, if I take. Some notion of continuum limit of Turev zero, I just get pure gravity with a cosmological constant, period. I don't get any particles. So that's why I don't usually think of these defects as being matter. Whereas
exactly.
I thought that you want... Like,
no, you're exactly right.
Again.
You're exactly right. But again, on this slide, I'm just looking at vacuum states. So on this slide, I'm looking at states for which the puncture carries no extra labeling, carries no extra degree of freedom, so carries no particle mass and spin. And indeed, in this case, we're just doing Turev zero. This is what I announced in the previous slides. The vacuum state, which we're looking at right now, is just given by the Turev zero TQFT. And then defects on top of this TQFT, or excitations on top of the vacuum state, will correspond to putting additional structure on the punctures, namely curvature excitations and torsion excitations. And this is where the punctures acquire a certain physical meaning, and from the physical point of view, we can think of these punctures as being point particles, in the sense that they carry mass and spin.
Does this answer your question?
Yes, okay, thank you.
Okay.
So now we go to slide number 13. So on slide number 13, we kind of explore a very important structure of this construction, which is the so-called tube algebra. So what we have on the previous slide, two slides ago, is states Q on the cylinder. And again, the cylinder is the two-puncture two-sphere. Now, what we can do is that we can, in fact, stack or glue together two-puncture two-spheres. And in fact, we can glue a two-puncture two-sphere to any other punctured manifold. And if we do this gluing, we're not going to change the topology of this manifold, because one of the punctures get absorbed by the gluing, but then the other punctures compensate for the disappearing one. So what you can do is, in a sense, stack cylinders together. So you can think of these states, Q, defined on the cylinder, as operators, in fact, in the sense that they can be taken and glued to other states. So what happens is that if we stack two cylinders together, so if we glue two of these states together, and now this is possible because, as I said, the punctures have some internal structure. They have a marked point. What we can do is just match this marked point and stack the cylinders together. We see that if we glue two cylinders together, we get back a cylinder. So in terms of the states, Q, the same thing happens. If we glue two of these states together, which I draw graphically on this figure, so I have some internal Q state, and out of it I glued a second Q state, then we can do a series of these local moves, which we had earlier, with these rules of graphical calculus. We can do all these Packner F moves, and after a series of moves, we can convince ourselves that this product of two Q operators is given by a linear combination of, again, a Q operator, times some coefficient alpha, which depends on these quantum 6J symbols, which in turn also depends on all the spin labelings. And this, in fact, defines the multiplication rule. And this multiplication rule, this structure, was introduced by Okneanu, in fact, in the year 2000, I think, and studied recently by Müger. And this is the so-called tube algebra. So in this sense, we can see that the Q states on the cylinder, they are kind of hybrid objects, in the sense that they define both a vector space and an algebra.
So intuitively, what we have in mind now, what we would like to do, is find quasi-particle excitations in this model. So these quasi-particle excitations are the excitations on top of the TQFT, the defects on top of the TQFT. And here I use the term quasi-particle excitation because this was essentially investigated in the condensed matter literature, where all these examples of TQFT are so-called string net models, which are supposed to be fixed-point models of description of topological order. And people are interested in quasi-particle excitations on top of these fixed-point string net models. So what we can convince ourselves is, so there are several ways to argue for this, and maybe we can come back to this later on if it's not clear now, is that these quasi-particle excitations, which we're looking for, they are representations of, or more precisely modules, over this Q algebra, or this cube algebra, which we obtain by gluing Q states together. So what we look for is for some particular states, xi, which have some stability property. Namely, if we act with this state on the cylinder, which as we argued can be thought of as an operator, if you act with this operator Q on these states, we want to have this stability property. Now if I make just a slight detour towards, again, the group picture to argue why if we have this stability property, we will have in fact the structure of a quantum double. So in the group picture, consider the following flux projectors, XH, so which are labeled by a group element H. If these are projectors, we have that this multiplication is XH times XH prime, given by this delta times XH. Now, if you consider...
I think when the discussion takes place in perimeter, nobody else can hear it, so for us it is just a waste of time. So please repeat the question.
So Laurent asked what these fluxes have to do with the usual fluxes, and my answer was that these fluxes XH here are in fact some exponentiated version of the fluxes, which is why I labeled them here with the group elements.
So I'm considering now two kind of group elements, H and gauge transformations, and I'm looking at the algebra given by these exponentiated fluxes and these group elements, so these gauge transformations.
So Laurent is asking what I mean by these exponentiated fluxes. So these were the creation operators of the BF representation. So the operators which on the Hilbert space act by shifting the group element on the right by example.
Mark, we cannot hear anything.
Sorry. So I was answering to Laurent that these fluxes XH are the exponentiated fluxes of the BF representation. So I'm just making a remark here to argue that if we have these two objects, which we have in the BF representation, we have these exponentiated fluxes as creation operators, and we can look at gauge transformations. And gauge transformations, they act on the fluxes by conjugation, which means that on the second point here, we have this relation between the commutation of an exponentiated flux and a gauge transformation. Now, if we combine these things together, what we get is that the algebra of these two things, these exponentiated fluxes and this gauge transformation, if you look at this multiplication rule, we have, we can just compute what is here on the right-hand side. And this, just by definition, in fact, is the multiplication rule of the Drinfeld double of the group that we started with. So this is just a schematic way to argue again that in this picture, if you work in this BF representation, if we have exponentiated fluxes generating curvature excitations and gauge transformations generating torsion excitations, what we're in fact dealing with secretly is not the gauge group we started with, but the Drinfeld double of the gauge group, which is indeed labeling point particles. Now I would like to make this more precise in this quantum group case. If we go on slide number 14.
Can we just stay with 13 for a minute? So on the top line, top part of the slide, you're talking about Q. And then in the bottom part, the Q is completely disappeared. So my first question is about Q itself. Are the new states obtained by operating by Q on the vacuum state, when you say Q is both a state and an operator, is the relation that you start with a vacuum state and operate by Q operator, then you get another state which you call Q again. Is that correct? Or?
Yes, exactly. So I will make this more precise in the next two slides. So in fact, the operator with which we have to act on the vacuum is not really a Q, but out of these Qs, we can create construct the creation operators. And indeed, then by acting on the vacuum with this creation operator, we get generate the states on the cylinder, or in fact, the state on any punctured manifold.
Okay, so but you still have a law of composition for the Q operators. So on your Hilbert space, are the Q operators unitary?
Yes.
Okay, so therefore that law looks very much like the law of the while operators in ordinary quantum mechanics. You know, the product of two while operators again is sum of the while operators, and therefore the vector space. The vector space itself is an algebra, so that looks very similar to that. And also in the while case, it is true that you can generate any state by operating repeatedly by the while operator on the vacuum. So I think that's what you're about to explain to us. Okay, my second question is, what is the relation between Q and X?
Yeah, so here, in fact, there is no, I cannot tell the precise relation between Q and X. This is just an analogy here, in fact. So I will, or maybe in the next slide, I will construct the quantum group analog of these labels of the Drinfeld double. So for the quantum group case, the Drinfeld double, so which is labeling this quasi-particle excitation, has a more complicated algebraic structure, in fact. And in fact, this is what I derive on the next slide.
On the next slide, I just quickly introduce this idea of the quantum double. So the idea is that, as we try to argue, we are looking for certain states, which will represent quasi-particle excitations, which have a certain stability property under the action of Q. And this, by definition, is just a module of the Q algebra. So you can think of this, of what is happening here, as analogous to what happens when we classify particles as representations of the
system. You have to stand closer, please. We can't hear again.
I was saying that you can think of what is happening here as analogous to what happens when we classify particles by looking at representations of groups. What happens here is that we want to obtain quasi-particles as representations or modules of these two algebra. And in fact, mathematically, it has been shown by Mutual.
Mark?
Yes?
Closer to the mic, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
It has been shown, in fact, that so the mathematical structure of these irreducible representations of this tube algebra, or the modules of this algebra, which are labeling the quasi-particle excitations, are in fact known mathematically, and they form another category, which is called the quantum double category, which I denote by Z of C here. And in fact, it turns out that because the category which we started with, so UQ of SU2 is modular, so has this property that the S matrix is not degenerate, there is a simple factorization of this quantum double category. So we just obtain it as two copies of the original category. You can think of these objects of the quantum double category as being, in a sense, labeled by, in a sense, two representations of UQ of SU2. So as I argued on the previous slide, we would like to find states which satisfy some stability property, because this stability property is in fact what characterizes these quasi-particle excitations. So in fact, you can see that because of this multiplication rule of the Q algebra, the Qs themselves are not really a projector. If you combine two Qs, we get the linear combination of Q basis states again. So it is convenient to go to another basis, which we call here the O basis. So these new basis states, which have this graphical representation, so you can see that these basis states are defined with some non-trivial braiding, in fact.
So there are, again, these two punctures, reminiscent of the fact that we're working on the cylinder. Then there is this loop with strands I and J, and this loop has some non-trivial braiding with the vacuum line going around the right puncture. So, okay, you can just think of this basis state as some definition of a new state, and it just turns out that we want to work with these new basis states because they satisfy some very convenient properties. Namely, they satisfy a projection condition, which is that if we stack two of these basis states together, if we multiply them, we recover identically the same basic states. So these are projectors. They also form an orthonormal basis in, admittedly, an inner product which I haven't specified so far, but for this discussion, it's just a technical detail which is not important. And also these operators, these basis states, they are stable in the sense that if I want to pull a ribbon with label L over one of these basis states, what I essentially recover is again a linear combination of these same basis states with some coefficient in front, this coefficient omega, and this coefficient omega, which we can just compute explicitly here, because this is just a computation of graphical calculus using the rules which we introduced before. We can just compute what this omega is, and it turns out that this omega is known in the literature as a half-braiding tensor, and this is in fact the element which labels representations of this quantum double category. So all this to say that if you have these basis states on the cylinder, we can look at these O states, which have this projection property and this stability condition. And out of this, in fact, we are going to be able to create our creation operators. So if you want, you can think of these basis states as being the quasi-particle excitations around the punctures. So now, in the next slide, slide number 15, for the last slide, I will in fact do what I claimed. I will use this basis states O to glue them in this particular way to form these new ribbon operators. So I introduce these double lines, these ribbon operators, which go from the one gray area labeled Xi bar to a gray area labeled Xi. So you can think of these gray areas now as being the quasi-particle excitations leaving at the punctures. And this is just defined, in fact, as this weighted sum over the graph which is on the right-hand side. And you see that this graph on the right-hand side is just constructed by some gluing of these O basis states. So now, the reason for which we want to construct and consider such ribbons, so one reason for which, in a sense, these ribbons are the good creation operators of the theory, is that these ribbons satisfy a certain neat sliding property. And this sliding property, in fact, you can show that it is equivalent, just algebraically, to some so-called naturality condition, which has to be satisfied by the half-braiding tensors, which are representations of the quantum double. So this just means that we are we are allowed to freely slide this creation operator over the strands of just a standard spin network graph. So in the following sense, so in the sense which is described by this equation. So this means that if you want to create a particle excitation, quasi-particle excitation, we are free to take this ribbon and move it all over the graph to create the excitation at the puncture which we want, in fact. So for example, so I don't show the computation here, but this is essentially what happened. If you act on the vacuum state of the cylinder, so the vacuum state of the cylinder is just given by these two punctures where around one of the punctures we put this dashed line. So this is this dashed line which is imposing that we have the vacuum state. And indeed, we can check that if we act with this excitation operator on this vacuum state, we recover the initial the basis state O. And in fact, to just push further now the analogy with usual holonomy and flux operators, you can think of these ribbons as being either open or closed. And in fact, the open ribbons are analogous to the flux operators. and the closed ribbons are analogous to homonymy operators. And you can see that if we work with these ribbons, in fact, what we kind of automatically get in this picture is that you automatically have the Tourette-Zero model, so the background TQFT, with excitations given by these ribbons. And these excitations, as we argued, are precisely describing point particles, because they describe curvature and torsion excitations, so mass and spin of point particles. Okay, so now I jump to the last section, so just conclusion and some perspectives. So slide number 16. So the first part is just to realize that we have some a new framework and some new results. So what we already knew from before is that, so before this talk, is that we had this new BF vacuum for the group SU2, which is a physical state of BF theory, and this can be constructed in two and three spatial dimensions. Then if you work with this kinematical vacuum, we can construct the kinematical continuum limit in the sense that we can construct a full continuum Hilbert space which supports arbitrarily many curvature excitations. And I argued that this is a nice representation because it allows for a geometrical coarse graining of the fluxes. And what we hope is that this will sort of help us extract the dynamics of the theory and extract physics in a new and maybe more an easier and more physical way. Now what we did in this talk is to find that the same structure, so the same vacuum structure, namely a background TQFT and excitations on top of the TQFT, can be extended to the case of a non-zero cosmological constant. And to do this extension, we just have to consider new TQFTs with their defects. So what we did here is to accommodate for a cosmological constant by looking at the Tourette-Zero TQFT with defects on top of this Tourette-Zero TQFT. And this, in fact, establishes the link with other other areas of physics, in fact, and most importantly, the condensed matter literature, where, in fact, these things were investigated for the first time. And it turns out that this is indeed the right mathematical framework to describe the phases which we obtain as fixed points of the cross-graining flow. So now this also opens the road to some generalizations and applications. So what we should do is understand how this vacuum structure can be constructed for other quantum groups and Lorentzian signature, other signs of the cosmological constants. Of course, this has to be extended to 3 plus 1 space-time dimensions. What is also very interesting is to try to see if we can put a dynamics for the defects. And I refer you to the LQGS by Wolfgang Wieland on April 5th. And then we should try to apply this to extracting physical predictions, so study cosmology and physics of black holes. And I stop here. Thank you.
Since we are at the end of the time, can we have one or two quick questions?
Yes.
Okay, here's a quick question. When you go up to 3 plus 1 and add a dimension to space, does the dimension of the defects also go up by 1?
Yes. Yeah. The dimension of the defects goes up by 1. So just like the flat SU2 BF vacuum, we already constructed...
Mark, we can't hear you.
Yeah, in the case of the flat SU2 BF vacuum, we already constructed this, and this is indeed what happens. The defects are given by not the vertices of the triangulation, but the bounds of the triangulation. So they are one-dimensional. The problem is that here, we want to use this extension to 3 plus 1 dimensions. What we can look at is the Krengeta QFT instead of the Tourette-Zero QFT. The problem is that it is not known, just purely mathematically, what is the structure of the QFT as an extended QFT. We don't know the Krengeta QFT how to label the defects.
Even point-like defects are one-dimensional defects. So this is what is, for the moment, preventing us from extending this to 3 plus 1 dimensions.
Okay, thank you.
If there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker again.